Welcome to Chase Your Dream, a podcast that believes that all dreams can come true if you have the courage to pursue them. Each week, we deliver the stories of a common person being successful by chasing the dream. I am your host, Shoman. Today, we will discuss about medicinal plant. And to throw light on this topic, we have among us Dr. Mark Merriweather Waterbergen from Texas. He is having a MS in medical chemistry and a PhD in physical organic chemistry. He brings science into the world of wild, edible and medicinal plant. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a big round of applause for Dr. Mark Merriweather Waterbergen. Dr. Mark, welcome to my show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to have another place to talk about plants.
So here we are to know more about plants. As you know that I am from India, and India is exposed to Ayurveda since ages. So we are very eager to know more and more about plants. So before we dip down to the history of plants and this type, we want to understand that how your journey has started from the childhood.
Oh, wow. So both my parents were children of the Great Depression. That was a terrible time when the economy in the United States was ruined back just before World War II. And so one of the ways the small farming communities where they were from got through that terrible time was through their knowledge of the edible and medicinal plants that were around. Back then, it was still common knowledge. It was just something people knew. It was passed on from family to family to family, you know, down the generations. I was blessed that both my parents thought that was still important information. So every day we would be out in the woods, in the wilds, in the fields, along the rivers where I grew up, and they'd be saying, oh yeah, this was used for this, this was used for that. And so it just became part of my childhood. I knew I wanted to be a scientist. You know, from if you're a scientist, you know you're going to be a scientist from like age five on. And so I knew I wanted to be a scientist. And as I delved more and more, just self-teaching myself the amazing properties of plants, I decided that's what I want to dedicate my life to. And so that's why I got the medicinal or the master's degree in medicinal chemistry, and then the PhD in physical organic chemistry. The physical organic chemistry, I don't make molecules. I look at the molecules that are available and figure out which ones would probably be best for a particular job. In the case of medicine, which may interact with the human biochemistry the best.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, interesting. So your actually first footfall was basically to stop the aging process, I believe. That was...
Yeah. And here the tradition in the when you're a senior in high school, you have to write down your goal, and mine actually wrote down in front of everyone that my goal is to stop the aging process through science, and I'm working on it. So far, so good. I'm still alive. So
after your graduation has been completed, you started as a basically a petroleum chemist rather than a pharmacist.
Yeah, and actually that kind of worked out. So when I graduated, I had specialized in natural products and, you know, the chemistry of plants. And I ended up in Houston, Texas, because I was in love with a lady who we're now 23 years married. So neither of us liked New York, where we had been going to school, moved to Houston. And the oil industry immediately handed me a whole ton of money and said, hey, come work for us. And so I spent my career, 18 years, using my knowledge of plant chemistry and natural products to come up with environmentally friendly replacements for traditionally less friendly oil field chemicals. My first patent was actually using cinnamon, the spice cinnamon, as a corrosion inhibitor for oil field equipment. And from there, it just continued on. And at the time, there was a great need for this. There was a big desire to come up with environmentally friendly replacements for, like I said, traditionally less friendly oil field chemicals. But at the same time, on evenings and weekends, I was teaching people the edible and medicinal plants around them. I created a website. It's one of the top websites for the edible and medicinal plant information. It's called foragingtexas.com, but actually the plants are found all over the world. A lot of the weeds here in North America are actually plants that were brought from elsewhere as food or medicine and have escaped into the wild because they don't have the insects that would normally eat them. So a lot of the weeds on there can be found, you know, everywhere. So I was doing that, and that became really popular. And then a little over a year ago, I was actually contacted by two people that said, hey, you know what? We want to start up a company of herbal supplements, bringing back ancient plants for modern issues. But we also want science, and we've looked all over, and we think you're the guy that can be the formulator and the face of the company. And so for over a year now, I've been the face and formulator for Medicine Man Plant Co. And it's finally, my dream has come true. I'm finally making the medicines using the natural plants and products and mushrooms for the wider audience. It's my dream. It's so awesome. I love it. Yeah.
Excellent. So 14 patents you have is there under your name, so which you have not told
Yep.
So now the questions for the medicine man. So what are medicinal plants and what is its importance?
Okay, so that's a very interesting question because there's so many different ways, so many ways you can approach it. But in the end, I'm going to approach it, a medicinal plant is some plant or mushroom, mushrooms technically aren't plants, but we're going to wrap them in there, that contain chemical compounds that have a known predictable effect on the human body in a beneficial way. So, and thinking about spices, for a lot of spices in cooking, say turmeric, it's well known, well documented, lots of science that shows turmeric is great for different inflammation. Inflammation is usually one of the effects the body has against any sort of injury or infection. By inflaming or causing the cells around the injury or the infection to swell up and kind of seal off that area, it limits the damage or the bleeding. And in the case of an injury, if you're cut, the inflammation, the swelling that occurs by the damaged cells and the healthy cells around it, that's part of the whole process to keep the blood inside the body, you know, to stop the bleeding. In the case of other infections, it's to kind of reduce the flow of blood and lymph through the body to, again, localize that infection so it can't spread throughout the body. But at the same time, that inflammation causes pain, which is actually a warning system that, hey, there's something wrong here, and other health issues. Because if you're not getting the circulation there, it's keeping the, you know, infectious virus or bacteria local in one area. But at the same time, the healing properties are slower to get in there. And so the body is trying to balance this. And so turmeric, one of the things it does is it reduces that inflammation effect in damaged or infected cells, which then allows other stuff to come in there, flow in more easily. So when you combine, say, with an infection, the turmeric to kind of reduce the inflammation that occurs, and then other things like, say, elderberry. Elderberry has been shown to increase the speed at which the white blood cells are produced, and the number of white blood cells. White blood cells are the warriors of your immune system. So by taking turmeric and the elderberry, you are opening up pathways for the warrior cells to come in and attack. So there's these balancing things that you're doing.
So this reminds me of my childhood days. So on my childhood days, when I used to play football at that point of time, so every day there was some injury. So my mom, what she used to do, she used to apply this turmeric on those places where there is an injury. So now I'm getting those points. Okay.
So it's a great one, yeah.
Yeah. So what are the things to be considered while collecting medicinal plants?
Okay, that's another, oh man, I love your questions. So one of the important things to understand is what potential dangers are in the soil or in the air or in the water. One of the things that makes a lot of plants so nutritious, especially wild plants nutritious or beneficial, is they are very good at absorbing things from the soil, which if it's things like copper or iron or manganese, things we need, that's great. If it's things like arsenic or mercury or other bad compounds, then that can be in the plant or on the leaf. So you need to have an understanding of what might have been applied to the land in the form of man-made toxins. But there's also particular cases where there are natural toxins. I'm in Texas, and in the east side of Texas, it was iron mining land. And where you naturally find iron, you also find mercury. So there are areas in East Texas where the iron mines used to be, they're no longer there, but that soil is naturally contaminated from the mercury that was with the iron. So you kind of have to understand that. So it's not just man-made toxins, there's also potential. Nature isn't always friendly. You need to understand that.
Yes.
And yes. Then one last thing is also what other creatures might be in there. So like, again, here in Texas, rattlesnakes. You know, before I start poking around in some bushes or something, I have my stick and kind of bang around to drive any snakes out. So, you know, things like that. So, you know, it's not just happy, you know, everything is good. There are things
so
you gotta
look. Any incident has happened that you poke your stick and a snake comes out and something?
About three times I poked a, and usually they, like, I'll stomp up because snakes can feel the vibrations in the earth. Mm-hmm. And so I'll purposely be stomping and then poking with the stick. And usually they go away from, you know, the stomping and the stick. But three times they decided to come towards me, and suddenly a snake is barreling out of the bush. And then I have a little dance I call the screaming scared man dance. Which, yeah, and twice has happened during classes, so, but no one's ever got it on video, thank God. So, but yeah, it's something you got to look out for.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what subtopics are of most interest to you in medicinal plants?
One of the things I really like discussing is the fact that plants actually have medicinal properties. There are a lot of people nowadays, modern science is where the medicine is, and plants are just, you know, bogus, they're fake. Mm-hmm. Plants have no powers over humans, as they drink their coffee and probably smoke their marijuana, and, you know, claim that it has no power. And something I like to point out to people is, think about this. If we look at an evolutionary sense, humans have been around for 83,000 generations or more. And during that time, they figured out that there are plants and mushrooms that have medicinal properties that help them feel better, that help support their health. And if you think from an evolutionary point of view, the survival of the fittest. So those that responded best to the plants were usually the most fit, were passing these genes on to their offspring. So we were, you know, genetically intertwined with these plants. We are genetically designed to respond favorably to these plants. Mm-hmm. And that's just something that once people start thinking about this, they go, you know, actually that kind of makes sense. That, you know, that's evolution in a nutshell. Whatever works gets, you know, passed on. Yeah. And so, you know, responding with the plants.
So how do you know if a wild plant is edible?
Okay, so I have a huge library of ethnobotanical historical records and just lots of books on, you know, what other people have figured out in the past. Here in North America, the estimate actually about 90% of the knowledge of edible and plants by the natives has been lost. Huh. And so, and that's a whole interesting tragic story in its own right, but I'm not experimental. I know enough about poisons and things like that that I'm not going to randomly take a plant and start playing with it. Mm-hmm. I need some record, someone else, some culture, some other, you know, people use this as food or medicine. And then from there, I will start experimenting with something. I'll find out how they prepared it. And then based on their preparation methods, you know, did they have to cook it or could it be eaten raw? Then I will start experimenting, using it in different recipes and so forth, too. Mm-hmm. Then there's also, basically in about the 1980s, the belief that plants actually did have medicine kind of came back into vogue, and quite a few researchers started studying it again. So I was blessed. I was at the early stages of that. Mm-hmm. My professors were always big into natural products and medicinal properties. And so learning from them and, you know, helping continue that information along has been fascinating. So there's a lot of plants that may not have been recorded as used as medicine, but there's enough research done on the molecular compounds, the chemical compounds in them, that even traditionally non-medicinal plants are now being used as sources to find new interesting shaped molecules and seeing what powers these molecules might have in the human body. It's absolutely fascinating. So just thousands and thousands of articles every year are published on this.
So if we could turn back the time and go to those cavemen era, so those persons actually use these plants as a medicinal property. So I just want to understand how they figure out, because at that time science was not advanced, nothing was that, so how they figure out?
That another great question. And so the closest we have to answering that is a combination of speculation and also talking to some of the tribes and cultures that still have a record going way back. And because it's such a fascinating one, I know it's not medicinal, but it was used by that, in the Andes, cocaine. The process of taking the leaves to the finished powder is a 13-step chemical process. It's not something that could have been developed just, you know, accidentally, randomly, trial and error. Scientists have actually calculated how long would it take to just randomly trial and error would it take to go from the leaf to the powder, and it's longer than the existence of the universe. But when you talk to the natives, their response invariably, in whether it be the Andes or Aborigines or some of the African, they always say, the plants told us. And as a scientist, Western trained scientist, I go, ooh, what? But more thinking into it, you run into language barriers. And so this is going to sound like I'm drifting off topic, but just bear with me for a bit. So there have been a number of cases where people have been lost at sea and they're in a life raft floating around. They have a fishing kit, and early on they're catching the fish and they're eating the meat of the flesh. And they're okay. But because the meat has some limited nutritional value, they're not getting everything. But repeatedly, there have been cases where after like about a month at sea eating just the fish meat, a switch flips in their brain and they're now looking at the, you know, the eyeballs and the entrails, the guts of the fish, the skin of the fish, and going, I really want to eat that. That looks really delicious to me. Where before they were like, yeah, you know, I'm not going to eat that. But suddenly the body recognizes, you know what? There are nutrients in the fish eyeballs. There are nutrients in the guts that you need. And so the question is, how does the brain recognize that? My personal theory is through the sense of smell. So the nose is the most directly connected organ to the brain. And one of the things I've shown is in a lot of hunter-gatherer tribes that are still around is they have exceptionally developed senses of smell. And something that I spend a lot of time hiking and backpacking and so forth, and something that people notice when they spend a lot of time out in nature is their sense of smell becomes sharpened. The plants, they've shown, plants communicate by pheromones, by chemical signals. If you have a plant that's suddenly being eaten by a bug, it releases chemicals that basically are a warning to all the other plants around it. And these other plants, they're not just the plants of the same species, but even different species can sense these pheromones, and then they start producing anti-bug, you know, compounds, things to make them taste worse or poison the bugs or things like that. So plants already have this rich communication through pheromones and, you know, olfactory molecules. And so my thoughts are through that, the brain analyzes and goes, hey, you know what? If you took this plant that's releasing these molecules and roasted it a bit and it changes it into these molecules, try that. That's going to be what you want. So that's one side of it. There's the other theory. I have two different theories on this, and if you don't mind me going on. So the other is, okay, you got a tribe and they're in an area and they're healthy and they're getting big, they're healthy, so they're getting more people. And then they realize, okay, you know, we got too many people here. So half of you, why don't you head over that mountain there and, you know, see if there's any place over there. And so they go off and they find, you know, a river and a lake and stuff. And they go, okay, this is nice. They start living over there. But then they notice they're not as healthy as they were back at the other place. And someone in the tribe is smart enough, well, you know what? Most of the food we were eating back there, most of the plants and stuff are here, but there's one or two that aren't. Maybe if we go back and get some of those plants and bring them back here and eat them, you know, let's just try it. Let's just try it. You know, because even then, you know, the people weren't any dumber back then than they are now. And they were much more in tune with their environment and, you know, they had to survive. So I think they went back and said, you know, let's just, you know, bring these plants back here. And hey, you know, the scurvy is now gone, you know, things like that. So again, kind of not so much trial and error as much as, hey, we no longer have this in our diet and now we're getting this problem. Why don't we add that back to our diet and see what happens? But again, it's all speculation. Unless we get a time machine, we won't really know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of sad how much of the human history really is unknown, because it would be fascinating to know the truth on.
So these tribes are actually now carrying that legacy. So they know the medicine, maybe their ancestors have told them, and that legacy they're again carrying out at this point of
time. Yep.
So how can we preserve medicinal plants?
Man, okay, another great question. So now we're gonna talk about plant biology. Remember, plants have a cell wall. It's a hard, rigid structure that keeps everything inside the cell inside and everything outside outside. And all those medicinal compounds are inside those cells. So you need some way of getting them out into, say, your food or your drink, if you're making a medicinal tea. If you're eating them, it's fine. You're chewing them up, you're crushing up, chewing the structures, you're breaking it up, you're swallowing it, and away you go. So that's fine. But if you want to store the stuff for later use, the best thing to do is to just let it hang and air dry. So in plants, when a plant realizes it's dead, the last thing it does is trigger an enzyme whose purpose is to start breaking apart that cell wall to put holes through it. Because the plant wants to take all those nutrients that are inside the cell and return them into the soil for its own reuse or its baby's use. So they evolve to break down their own cell wall. And as long as there is water present, that enzyme, it requires water to work. If there's water inside the plant, it will work. If you take a plant and just hang it to dry, in my house, there are plants hanging all over the place. They're just drying, because during that drying process, that enzyme is breaking those holes through the cell wall. Once those holes are big enough, now the water can escape. Water evaporates. Once the water is gone, that enzyme stops working, and now you have a perfectly dried plant with lots of holes in the cell wall. So now when you make a tea or an infused oil out of it, there's escape routes for those molecules.
Okay.
People ask, can I quick dry it in an oven or in a dehydrator? And the answer is no. That will force the water out, but you won't get those openings in the cell wall that you want. So yeah, if you, I always recommend, even for herbs, for culinary herbs, let them hang and dry for at least 2 weeks. Let those openings form, the plant dry out, and then seal it in an airtight container. The flavors you get from it will be much richer. The medicinal compounds will be higher concentration, much better use, and shelf stable. The basic rule of thumb with a dried medicinal plant is it will remain medicinally useful until the plant is ready to be harvested again the following year. You know, assuming most plants have a season during the year, you get it, you dry it, you put it in the jar, and then you use it up until it's ready again, then you take the old dump out, you know, then replace it with the fresh.
So according to you, which plant is having the greatest medical?
Right now, I would say the elderberry. So the elderberry, it is found in Europe and in North America. I'm not sure if it's found in India, but I'm sure you can find the extract. But it is one of the most potent immune system empowerers there is. As far as, so the immune system, you have the innate and the selective immune systems. The innate is non-specific. Anything that comes in, the innate, if as long as it recognizes it as not you, it's going to try and attack and kill it. But there are times when the virus or the bacteria becomes too strong and overwhelms the innate, and that's where it activates the selective. The selective is where you think of the white blood cells with the antibodies and all that sort of thing. They're coming in and doing the attack. So the elderberry, it supports both the innate, makes it more vigorous in its non-selective defense. But then if the innate gets overwhelmed, it also increases the speed and number of response of the selective immune system. That was great. Turmeric, another great one, again, because it helps reduce the inflammation that is so common with so many things and allows everything else to go better. Ginger is a great one. I have what I call the blood pressure pill, and ginger is amazing. It has some really potent antioxidants, and there's some really good research showing how the compounds in ginger help with overall cardiovascular health. In particular, they help clean out the plaque that builds up in the blood vessels and clogs them. The FDA here in the United States is going to come after me for saying this, but so be it. But at least in North America, the heart disease is one of the biggest issues, health issues facing, you know, people. And so anything you can do to help the cardiovascular system is really good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there are different anti-cancer plants. I'll ask you, there in India, do you have any plants that are known to be particularly slimy? Like the raw, you know, gooey, sticky, slimy sort of material. Here in North America, well, it came from Africa. There's okra, there's prickly pear cactus, there's aloe vera.
Aloe vera is over here.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So one of the things that aloe vera does, and the mucus in it, is that mucus binds really tightly to sugars, mm-hmm, and only slowly releases it. So with type 2 diabetics, one of the issues is they get the sugar spikes.
Yes. So aloe vera juice, that has been recommended by the doctors over here.
Yeah. And cinnamon helps too. Cinnamon helps in a different mechanism.
Yes.
But the aloe vera juice, it binds to the sugar and only slowly releases it. So instead of getting a spike, you get more of a subtle thing that your body doesn't, you know, respond to as harshly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you are having problems producing enough insulin, if you get that huge spike, you're going to run into problems. But if you're getting a nice slow release, the insulin that you can produce can come in and help. Mm-hmm. Whereas with cinnamon, it actually changes the way your gut, your intestinal tract, absorbs and passes sugar from the intestines into the blood. So they work great together.
In India, we are much more exposed to turmeric. Basically, in all our food items, we use turmeric. Even at late night, we use milk with turmeric.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things we do. So actually, my next question was supposed to be 9 most powerful medicinal plants and their science value, which you have already started.
Okay. All right, yeah. So we already talked about the elderberry and ginger. We talked a little bit about cinnamon. We talked a little bit about slimy plants like aloe vera. Mm-hmm. So another really good one that is found all over the world is what's called self-heal or heals all, also known as Prunella vulgaris. This is a member of the mint family. And if you look up, let's say you look up Prunella vulgaris cancer research, Prunella vulgaris antiviral research, mm-hmm, all this, it comes up like, yep, it helps, it works. So it's one of these unsung things that the people in the know about, Prunella vulgaris, worldwide mint, but it is antibacterial, it is antifungal, it is antiviral, it is anti-cancer, it's loaded with antioxidants. That's why it got the name self-heal or heals all, because the herbalists all over the world discovered, hey, this particular little mint does great things for the tribe. And so research has confirmed that, yeah, it really does help in a lot of things. So kind of as a general tonic, it's really good there. Mm-hmm. If you flip over to the mushroom side of things, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, there is the reishi mushroom, the Ganoderma then suddenly the second name I lost. But in China, it was considered the mushroom of immortality, and it was only allowed for use by the emperor himself. But again, this is one of those things that when science started looking at it, they go, wow, this does everything. There are two anti-cancer medications made from commercial anti-cancer medications. One helps protect the healthy cells from being damaged by the chemotherapy drugs. If you think about chemotherapy drugs, basically they're poison, trying to poison the cancer cells before the healthy cells die. Mm-hmm. And this reishi mushroom has been found, or an extract from it, has been found to strengthen the healthy cells and make them even stronger and more resistant to the chemotherapy while not giving that same strength to the cancer cells. The other compound that they extract from it and use commercially has been shown to prevent return of cancers, or reduce the chances, greatly reduce it. You know, maybe not completely eliminate it in everyone, but in a large number of people, it reduces the return of cancer. So now if you think about this, not from a cancer point of view, but as a general health tonic, it protects, it makes healthy cells more resistant to toxins. We encounter a lot of toxins in the world. And so a daily dose of reishi is great for just a general strengthening of the cells in your body to make them more resistant to environmental toxins. Not just the chemotherapy drugs, but most, you know, maybe not all, and maybe not in everyone. There's still a genetic component to it, but it helps the body resist the toxins it encounters every day. And then with the cancer preventative, or preventing tumors from returning, well, if you don't have tumors to begin with and you're taking it, it still works to help reduce the chance of developing tumors. So hey, you know, as a cancer preventative, again, you know, the here in the United States, the FDA says, ooh, you can't say that. No, you know, but the science is there. So, you know, there's lots of research on it showing, yeah, it works. And they've commercialized it. So, yeah, that's a big one. And these, you can get kits to grow them. You can buy the powdered stuff. They are a kind of a tropical, right on the edge of tropic sort of mushroom. So here in Houston, Texas, where I'm located, there are some reishi mushrooms that grow here. So I make my own medicine from that. Mm-hmm. Okay, another really good one is sage. Just the regular culinary cooking sage.
Okay.
There's a lot of great research on that for helping mental. It helps as a focusing agent. It has been shown to help with memory and recall. And so it's very useful for, especially as people get older and the brain starts to get a little fuzzy, it helps keep the action strong. So there's some really good research there. And, you know, a healthy brain is a good thing. The more, you know, you're less likely to do something stupid that will harm your health other ways. So, okay. Another really great one is burdock root. Okay. And that, again, mainly came from Asia, but now it's found all over the world. Mm-hmm. It's considered both a food. I love pickled burdock. Wonderful, wonderful food. Tasty, yummy. I also shred it, use it in stir fries. But medicinally, the burdock root has been shown to speed up the action of the liver. So the liver is the waste disposal system of the human body. Mm-hmm. It's getting rid of these toxins and these waste products. And even fatigue products. Like one of the things I like to point out, if you're working hard and your muscles get tired, mm-hmm. it's because lactic acid is building up in the muscles, and it can only be removed from the muscles as quickly as it can be removed from the blood by the liver. So if your liver is acting more quickly, it can get rid of that lactic acid, which has an effect on endurance, mm-hmm. as opposed to also just getting rid of all the other toxins your body's encountering. So burdock root, amazingly good at just activating the liver, getting it running at full speed, as you know, strong as it can do, to keep you clean of all the waste and the toxins that the liver is designed to remove from your body. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a healthy liver goes so far in taking care of lots of others.
Yes.
So,
true.
Yeah. In fact, if I had to pick one herb, one plant that I would use medicinally, and that was the only one, it would be burdock root. Because by supporting the liver, I get everything else is supported too. The immune system may not be responding as quickly as, you know, it would from elderberry, but the overall health would be much stronger, and you know, there'd be less things cluttering up the body, getting in the way of its own ability to take care of itself.
True. Very true.
Okay, how many have we covered? I don't know.
We can cover many. I have many more also. Not an issue.
Okay. So another great one, since we're talking about the liver, is milk thistle.
Milk thistle, which, yes.
Milk thistle.
The fast yellow milk. The yellow milk, the fast milk part.
Yep, and the seeds. There's a compound called silmarillin in the seeds that has been shown, it's a what's called a heptoprotective. So if you eat a poisonous mushroom, generally what happens, there is compounds in the mushroom that go through your digestive system, get into your blood, and they're okay there. They get to the liver, and the liver starts breaking it apart, and now these parts that the broken molecule are extremely poisonous and damaging to the liver and start destroying the liver cells. It's what we call in medicinal chemistry a suicide substrate, where the molecule that you consume is not the problem. It's what your body breaks it into while trying to get rid of it that is the problem.
That is the problem.
And in the mushrooms, it starts breaking into molecules that are very, very damaging to liver cells. So if you've eaten a poisonous mushroom, basically the one medicine they have is an extract from milk thistle that helps, basically helps the, it speeds up the liver cells' ability to reproduce and repair themselves, trying to make that happen more quickly than the mushroom is killing it. So it's still a rush. And if it doesn't work, then the next step is a complete liver transplant, where they have to take your liver out and give you a new liver. But the milk thistle, it is effective enough, especially in lower doses, at helping the liver repair the damage in real time. Now, there are other things that can cause liver damage. I mean, drinking. If you drink too much, you can end up with a damaged liver. Certain acetaminophen, you know, I don't want to give, but there are, you know, problems with it causing liver damage, hepatitis, or other, there are other medications that they say, you know, you got to keep checking your liver because this medication can damage the liver. And so the milk thistle is great at counteracting, or at least helping the liver rebuild its cells and protect its cells from those things trying to damage the liver cells. So it's separate from speeding up the action of the liver. It's just actually protecting those liver cells. So, yeah, and again, that's really important, especially in modern lifestyle. There's a lot of things out there that people do or don't do that ends up damaging the liver.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now,
my next question is, there is a huge debate going on now in the world about the protein part, plant protein and animal protein. So if you can distinct which protein is best for human being, or rather for the animal.
Okay, so this is based on my study of scientific studies of ancient cultures and the evolution of humans and things like that. So, spoiler alert, I am pro-meat, pro-animal protein, pro-fat, but there's more to it than that. It's not just the muscle and the fat that we should be eating. I firmly believe all the organ meats, because that's how we evolved. And I actually just had a discussion on this morning with some people about that. If you look at humans, at where we are now, one thing that really sets us apart from the animals, besides our big brain, is our ability to sweat. We are fantastic at sweating. That means we are fantastic at releasing excess heat that builds up in our body.
Yes.
So we are loosely covered with hair. You know, I got a big beard here, but for the most part, we don't have you know, body hair. We have amazing sweat glands in our armpits, our groin, our feet, and our entire body is capable of dispersing heat. Now, if you look at that, one of the abilities it gives us is we can run farther and faster than any other creature. So if you look, they've done this over and over. They have had a human race a horse in a 24-hour period. The human can always go much farther than the horse. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, there are animals that can, in sprints, you know, the cheetah, the coot, you know, mm-hmm. things like that, that can just blow. I mean, most animals for short sprints can just take off from us. Mm-hmm. What we have is we have the ability to keep going after them, which has led to what's called persistence hunting. Mm-hmm. And this still takes place by the different cultures around the world where they, you know, they see an animal and they start chasing after it and the animal runs off and goes, okay, I escaped, lays down, rests a bit, and then here the humans come again. And it takes off and it goes running and it gets mm-hmm. a little farther. And so they basically, through this repeated process, the animal just gets tired, exhausted, lays down, and off we go.
Yes.
And so you don't need this ability to run incredible distances and sweat huge amounts to release the heat mm-hmm. to get an orange off a tree, you know, a plant out of the ground. It really shows from an evolutionary point of view that that's what we were doing. We were chasing after, because when you look at the, not just the calories, but the nutrients, but the calorie density, rather than looking at the protein, because yeah, there are beans and things like that where mm-hmm. you can get protein, but the density mm-hmm. of the fat and the calories available in the fat are way better than the calories you can get from other things. And one of the things as a foraging instructor that I have to, you know, teach people over and over is that, yeah, it's easy to get the vitamins and the minerals and the antioxidants and the phytochemicals and all these things, minerals from plants. Where you have the hard time is getting the calories. Mm-hmm. The calories are located in the seeds, the nuts, and the tubers of the plants, you know, mm-hmm. where they basically have energy stored mm-hmm. to fuel the plant's growth until it can do photosynthesis. Mm-hmm. So the seeds, the nuts, the tubers, that's where the calories are. And those are generally very seasonal. So they're only available at certain times of the mm-hmm. year. And they're usually not available in large quantities until we figured out agriculture and started, you know, mass producing it. Mm-hmm. So it's not the protein that we needed from the animals so much. It's still, animals are a great source of protein. It's the fats from them mm-hmm. as a calorie source, as a dense calorie source. So again, nowadays with the vegan diet, yeah, you can get all the proteins. You can get everything you need from a vegan diet. So mm-hmm. you know, have at it if that's what, more power. But from an evolutionary point of view, if you look at the different cultures, you know, there aren't any nowadays. Again, maybe way back then in some sort of area, there may have been cases where there were people that survived purely off the plants. Mm-hmm. But the hunter-gatherers that we know of, it was hunter and gathering. You know, it wasn't just gathering. So mm-hmm. they understood the energy density available to them from animal fats that nothing else could meet.
Okay. So which leaves are used for medical purposes?
Oh, wow. Okay. That's an interesting question. So I already mentioned the self-heal. Mm-hmm. So it's the leaves of that. If you go into Rosella, or it is hibiscus saffron, I can't remember the scientific name on that. But the in that case, it's the calyx, the Rosella hibiscus. You might be familiar with,
yes,
hibiscus.
Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah, and that's amazing antioxidants and great uses. But in that case, it's what's called the sepals. So you have the flower petals, and the next layer, I guess I got to put the hands this way, but often that look like petals, mm-hmm. botanists call the sepals, which aren't petals, but they're the part. The sage leaves for the brain. Another great one for the brain is the ginkgo leaf. So the ginkgo tree, it's a tree that originated in Asia, mm-hmm. and its leaves contain a compound that increase the blood flow to the brain. And by bringing more blood to the brain, you are bringing more oxygen and more glucose, the things the brain burns to do lots of thinking. So it assists with mental mood and so forth. Like, you know, after you've been studying for a test or, you know, working really hard on something, you're just drained because your body is a muscle in a way. You know, it is burning oxygen and glucose to do its thing. And after a long period of study, you're thinking really hard. It's as fatigued as if you were doing 100 push-ups and your arms got tired. And so by increasing the flow of blood to the brain, you are bringing more of the fuel to it. So that's a really great one.
So what, according, you're telling something?
No, I was just thinking out loud. That was my thinking noise.
So what are the common threats on medical plants?
Okay, so are you saying, is there a particular structural feature that would indicate it?
Yes.
Unfortunately, there are none. That, again, is a very common question. You know, is there some cheat that I can use to identify an edible or medicinal plant? And unfortunately, no. It really boils down to understanding the individual plants and, you know, being able to recognize the plants in the wild. If you're concerned about it, I recommend growing the plants. There's lots of places, you know, lots of things that do very well. Because they were medicinal plants, humans learned to cultivate them. Mm-hmm. And so medicinal gardens are a big thing around the world. Rather than just out in the wilderness looking at a plant and going, I wonder if this will help with that. No, that's a good way to end up poisoned. Yeah.
So how many medical plants are threatened with extinction?
Ooh, a great question. It's also hard to answer because it depends on the location and so, you know, and what's going on there. So worldwide, I would say there are probably hundreds or thousands of plants. I would say, look at it this way, of the plants in general that are in danger of extinction, I would say from my years of looking into plants and all this, I would say 10% probably have valuable medicinal use. So of the plants, you know, in danger of going extinction, at least 10% of them are probably valuable medicinal plants. Here in North America, there's a plant called the echinacea. It's a beautiful wildflower. The main medicinal components are found in the root. And so there's a big problem with echinacea rustling, where the people are going out into the wild, illegally harvesting it, you know, trespassing on private property or stealing it from parks or things like that, digging up the roots and then selling them to health food stores, you know, and herb shops. So, you know, if you have an unscrupulous storekeeper who's willing to buy the echinacea, no questions asked, that has fueled. It took the echinacea from being a very common, easy to find wildflower. They don't consider it endangered yet, but they consider it a species of concern that it is starting to rapidly disappear from its natural locations because people are harvesting it.
So what is the importance of herbal medicine in our daily life?
Oh, another good question. So I think going back to the evolutionary standpoint, that it really is what we designed to use. So if we can talk about the pharmaceutical industry for a second again, because that was what I planned on going into, that's what I studied. The first true synthetic medicine was the first developed in 1836 about a molecule called chloral hydrate, which found to be a very good sedative and what they called hypnotic, and it found use as an anesthetic. It was basically the first non-plant, non-mushroom medicine that scientists came up with and said, hey, this actually has power on the humans. Maybe we can make other molecules that have powers on human. And this was, you know, basically at the, you know, the beginning of the you know, when science was starting to replace nature as controlling nature. And so a lot of, you know, time and effort and chemistry and all this was put into coming up with these synthetic molecules to do stuff in the human body, because we can do it better than nature. When you're looking at nature, when you're extracting medicinal properties from plants or making a tea, because especially with wild plants, each plant can have a different concentration of the particular compound. So you can't just easily say, You know, just take 2 teaspoons of this and you'll get what you need. There's a little trial and error in there. There's also, you need to collect the plant, you need to dry the plant, you need to crush the plant. You know, there's work involved. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you figure out just an individual molecule, oh, and that's the other thing, testing the effect of an individual molecule is easier than testing the effect of an entire plant with all its thousands of stuff, because there's all sorts of things. And so again, here in the US, the FDA, the Federal Dietary, whatever, you know, the people that say what is medicine and what is not medicine, they say you have to test at an individual molecule level and see what its effect is on the human body. Mm-hmm. And from that, that's how you determine, is it medicinal or not? Long story short, if you have to supply medicine to millions or billions of people, it's much easier setting up a factory to make the molecules and pack them in a pill and go, here you go, take this pill. And yeah, there may be some side effects, but you know, just go with it. So medicine for the masses, especially with the number of people we have now, really is most efficient with mass production. Mm-hmm. If we wanted to grow the plants, what I tell people though, so yeah, the pharmaceutical medicine are for the masses, the herbs are for the elite, the people that understand the value, understand the powers, have the time and the resources to grow their own, to process their own, and make their own.
Right.
And so, luckily that is coming back. So, and that's like, you know, that was part of the reason for developing the Medicine Man Plant Co. Mm-hmm. Again, there was a time when there was a lot of fraud in herbal medicine, that they basically sell sawdust and claim it was some herb and it wasn't. And so one of the things I realized getting into this, that trust is so important. So I do testing of the products when it comes in from the fields, make sure there's no fillers or fake stuff in there. It is what I purchased from, you know, the sources. Then I also do the testing for the heavy metals and the pesticides and bacterial contamination and all the bad stuff. So before I let it into the production area, it gets tested. Then after it gets all mixed up and ready to put into the capsules, I get it tested again because accidents happen. I have trust issues. I don't trust anything. And so just in case someone accidentally added something wrong in there, it gets sent out for testing again, and then it gets made into the capsules, and I send it out for testing a third time before I release it. So the highest cost of my stuff is usually the testing. Because my signature is on the bottles. I have made a promise to you that this is what I say it is, and it'll do what I say it will do. And I can't afford to screw up my reputation like that. So, yeah.
So this actually comes, what I would understand, this actually comes from your profession, which you were actually, R&D you are doing. So that thing is in your blood now. So you're testing so many times. Yes,
like with the... in my own, developed something in the lab, but like I work for Baker Hughes. They don't make the molecules. They figure out what molecule you need. Then they talk to a chemical company and say, okay, make this molecule. And then you take it and then you test the hell out of it to make sure that what you told them to make, they have made. Because if they haven't, if they try and slip something past you, it can result in millions of dollars of damage or fines. You know, if something goes wrong in an oil well, someone gets hurt or you get a spill or something like that because what the people said it was turned out not to be. Yeah, you can't afford that. So yeah, no trust whatsoever in anyone. I'm going to test and test and test because it's just what's been drilled into me.
So you are also into medicine making workshop, which...
Yes.
So what are the medicines that you make and you recommend?
Okay, so there's different things that in the workshops. Part of it depends on the time of year and what wild plants are available. But there are some standard things that I like to do. And usually my goal is to teach them the techniques of making a tincture and making an infused oil and making a salve and making a fire cider. That because when it comes right down to it, the different herbal plants, there are different ways of taking them to maximize their efficiency. And the problem isn't so much getting the plant, it is knowing what to do with the plant once you have it. Mm-hmm. And so by teaching them how to make a simple tincture, trying to think off the top of my, so like the reishi mushroom that we talked about.
Yes.
So for that, you do what's called a double extraction. So there are compounds in the reishi mushroom that are soluble in alcohol and compounds that are soluble in water. So I show them how to first extract the alcohol compounds and then extract the water compounds and then combine them together and use them. Another thing we make is a cayenne pepper salve. So cayenne pepper, it is a great if you have muscle pain or chronic pain, because what it does is the capsaicin in the cayenne pepper, the hot molecule, actually it overwhelms and drains the nerve cell's ability to send pain signals. So this salve is used to, you rub it on, you know, a sore spot. I reached my back because a lot of people have back pain because they don't know how to properly lift. But you rub it on there and it hurts for a minute and then the pain goes away for hours because you basically drained the nerve cell's ability to make pain. So to make that, it involves first infusing a vegetable oil with the powdered cayenne pepper to extract the capsaicin, the particular compounds, straining that out, and then mixing it with beeswax to take it from an oil, a messy oil, into a nice firm salve that is more like a cream that you can apply. So we work through those steps. There's also a thing called fire cider. This is an oxymel. An oxymel is a combination of, or basically a vinegar extraction. Because again, with vinegar, usually we use apple cider vinegar, you have the acid and you have the water, so it extracts different types of compounds from certain plants. And so, and then you mix honey with that. So it's, we figure out what's available, figure out, we find things that can be, an oxymel, a tincture, or a double extraction, and a salve, and we work through how you take it from beginning to end to do that. So then when you have your herbal medicine book and it says make a salve out of it, okay, now the person has the confidence, I know how to do that, it's actually really easy, it's no longer intimidating. So the goal is to teach people how to not just do these four things, but help them realize it's not that hard, and there's all these plants. And now, when the book says, make a tea out of it, I know how to do that. Make an infused oil, I know how to do that. And away they go. And it's just wonderful. There's a saying, if you give a man a fish, he'll be fed for a day. If you teach a man to fish, he'll be fed for his life. And that's why I'm teaching them how to, the basics of turning the plants into medicines, because then once they have that down, they can take any of these plants and turn them into the medicine.
So, according to you, what are the herbal medicines that we should keep in the home for ready-made use?
Okay, so turmeric, big one. The sage, every morning before, a little plug here, before I developed the brain pill, I would actually put sage in my coffee. I'd put about 1/8 teaspoon in my coffee grounds, because I found I just thought better. As a scientist, I know I have to think. My brain is my moneymaker. And so the more clarity and focus I have, that works really good. The cinnamon. I have two teenage daughters. They go get their coffee and it's basically a milkshake. There's cream and sugar and caramel and all this stuff in there. And my rule is, okay, go ahead and do that, but you also have to put cinnamon in there, because I mentioned earlier, the cinnamon slows down the transfer of the sugars from the digestive tract into the blood. And so they won't get the sugar spikes. And I will tell you, give a teenager coming down on a sugar crash, it's not pleasant. So by, kind of leveling out the sugar, they don't get the crash, they don't develop the insulin issues, they don't get the diabetes, hopefully. So it's healthy there. Cayenne pepper. So cayenne pepper, along with the nerve suppression, it also has been shown to increase the body's burning of fat by about 5-6%. So because of that, I put cayenne pepper on everything just to help maintain weight. Because by speeding up the metabolism, you're burning more fat, Mm-hmm. One of the things, going back to the caveman times, you know, we evolved that when we come across something that has calories, high calorie content, our evolutionary instinct is eat as much of this as we can, because we don't know when we're going to get access to that sort of calories again. Mm-hmm. When we had limited access to calories, that made a good survival sense. But nowadays, most people have almost unlimited access to calories, and our bodies are showing that. And so by using the cayenne pepper in all my foods, every time I eat, I am keeping my metabolism bumped up to help burn that down. Another great one is oregano, the spice oregano. It has some really amazing antibiotic properties. So for fighting internal and external infections. Throughout human history, one of the biggest things that caused health issues were bacterial infections, and to a lesser extent, viral. But bacteria, like that infected wound or food poisoning, salmonella, E. coli, any of those sort of things, the oregano helps kill the bacteria that could be either, you know, you got in from bad food or an infected wound. Back in February here in Texas, we had a really unusual winter storm. We don't usually get blizzards here, but we actually had like 3 inches of snow, and it froze up everyone's pipes, so they had no water, and so they had no way of keeping clean and washing their hands after going to the toilet. Now that's very important. You don't want to transfer disease. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I was reminding people, okay, if nothing else, go into your kitchen cabinet, get that oregano, and just rub that on your hands to help try and kill some of the bacteria.
Right. So, yeah. So you are also an author. So a book has been published and another one will be published, I believe, in very short time. So what is that book that you have published and what is it all about?
Okay, so it's called The Idiot's Guide Foraging. There is a long series of books called Idiot's Guide to, you know, dancing, an idiot's guide to yoga, an idiot's guide, you know, all these different things, you know, idiot's guide to electrical repairs. So it is designed to teach people a skill. And so for me, I wrote The Idiot's Guide Foraging, and it had 70 plants that are found all across North America. And actually about half of them are weeds that are found all around the world, or also oak trees and things like that. But Idiot's Guide Foraging, big multiple pictures, and I should have thought we were talking about it. I would have had one to show you, but I don't have it here with me. But it was designed to really help someone who knows nothing about plants truly recognize and identify the plant. So it has multiple pictures of the entire plant, close up of the leaves, close up of the flowers, close up of the fruit or nut or whatever, and descriptions, and then how to use them. And then it also has 30 recipes for making really fancy, cool, delicious dishes from it. Some really neat foods. The new one coming out, it's actually the publisher wants to re-release that book, but we want to update it. So we're changing out 20% of the plants. We're putting new plants in there. I think we're actually putting some better plants in there than the first time. I think they're better because I have better pictures now. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the first book, I had to do all the photography and everything, and I only had 3 months to write the book, so I wasn't able to go out and get some pictures. So I went with pictures of plants that are found all across North America, easy to find, and I had good pictures of. Now I have better pictures of some plants, so I was able to put plants in there that I would have liked to put in before last time. But the other big change are the recipes. We're redoing all the recipes. And now the recipes are designed for what I call campfire cooking. So instead of having a nice fancy kitchen with all sorts of other stuff to make these fancy dishes, this is someone, you know, out in the woods with the book, camping, backpacking. Okay, what can I make? Oh, wow, I can make this, you know, just here with a pan and, you know, maybe a little butter or a little oil, and maybe a little flour, you know, but things that backpackers and campers and fishermen and, you know, outdoor adventure people will have with them on that sort of adventure. Or also, it turns out my books are very good with what we call survivalists. you know, the people that are worried about economic collapse or something like that, and they wanted a book that they could take with them out in the woods to survive in this new one. It'll actually be Outdoor Adventure Guide Foraging by Penguin Publishing. Mm-hmm. And now it's actually taking them to mind. So basically anyone who wants to run off in the woods and live, now we'll have a book that tells them what plants they can eat and how to easily convert them into tasty food with a minimum of fuss and basically a pot and a campfire. So
excellent.
Pretty excited about it, yeah.
So your nickname is Meriwether, right?
Correct.
So how do you get that name? What is the history behind that?
Okay, so in the backpacking culture in North America, you get what's called a trail man. If you're doing on a long hike, it's like you're trying to escape something. So rather than ask people's real name, they either, you know, you do something and you get the a nickname assigned to you. So in the early years of the United States, there was what's called the Lewis and Clark Expedition, which was Meriwether Lewis and John Clark. And their job, they left Washington, D.C. and explored the, you know, what was now going to be the United States from basically the Mississippi all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Meriwether Lewis's job was to record and identify different plants that might have some sort of use or value. So he was hanging out with the Native Americans, learning the plants from them, identifying the plants as he was going along. Whenever I was out hiking, I was stopping and looking at the plants and trying to figure out what the plants were and all this sort of stuff. And it drove my hiking, you know, companions nuts because it was slowing it down. And so they said, come on, Meriwether, we got it, you know. And so as teasing me, they started calling me Meriwether, and that became my trail name, my nature name. As a kind of, that's what I was doing. I was doing the same thing that Meriwether Lewis was doing back when
in
he was
exploring. Comedy show, yeah.
Yeah, and so it just kind of stuck. And I mean, let's face it, Vorderbruggen or Meriwether. Meriwether is just so much easier to say. And so, you know, away we go.
So given a chance to make this world a better place to live, what steps will you take?
Okay, one thing I really try and do is point out to people that about 10% of their nutrition can come from the plants around them. We already talked about the hard part of getting the calories, but the vitamins, the minerals, all that sort of stuff. I have a deal with my neighbors that they don't put weed killer down, they don't put bug killer down, and I keep their yard free of weeds, generally by eating them. So I spent time in China, and one of the things that fascinated me over there is no just pretty landscaping there. Everywhere that can grow crops has food growing, you know, in this, along the sidewalks, in the medians, inside, you know, traffic circles, all that.
Right.
Tops of buildings. If people realize the ability to grow food around them and the medicinal properties and all that, the impact it would have on the overall environment would be amazing. Because if you're getting 10% of your food from within walking distance of your health, of your home, that's 10% less agriculture land that's needed. It's 10% less fuel transported. It's 10% less pesticides and herbicides and all this sort of thing. That would have a huge change. But there's more. So again, going back to the whole caveman evolution, I really have three strong beliefs that I try and impart in people. Mm-hmm. And we already talked about, we evolved to use the medicinal plants. They are what our body thinks is medicine. Mm-hmm. We also, another belief I have is that the bodies we live in now that have evolved for that world 83,000 years ago is maladapted or poorly adapted for the lives we live now. I mentioned the free ability to, for most people, to get unlimited calories. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just a problem there. Another thing I like to point out is, if you look at all our floors, our sidewalks, everything is flat. Mm-hmm. It's a convenience thing. It makes it easier. We can walk along without thinking, you know, no problem. We did not evolve walking on flat ground. We evolved walking on uneven, slippery ground. And they've shown the more time you spend walking on uneven ground, the overall healthier you are, both mentally and physically. Your brain, as you're walking on this, it is constantly adjusting to things. It is getting a workout. You may not realize it, but your brain is thinking. This is the same sort of exercise. Now they say, as you get older, you should try and learn a new language or do word puzzles or something to exercise your brain. Well, they've shown you get just as much exercise working on uneven ground for a nice strong brain. It also strengthens the core muscles, improves the sense of balance. You're less likely to break, you know, fall and break a hip. Here in the United States, if you're 70 years or older and you fall and break a hip, that's pretty much a death sentence. The quality of life goes down so badly that people just say, you know what, I'm done. I'm out of here. So, but just, you know, being out walking in nature, the way we evolve gives us back that caveman health. So there's that. And then, so basically we need to incorporate more of the stuff that we grew up, we evolved doing. So walking on uneven ground. The other benefit from being outside, along with just the mental exercise, they've also shown that it greatly reduces attention deficit disorder problems. So just interacting, because again, when you're out in the wild off the trail, your brain is going, okay, where are the saber-toothed tigers? Where, you know, there's something out here eating. So it's constantly analyzing your ears, your nose, your skin, you're feeling the wind, all your senses become sharper. Your brain starts getting the input it was designed to get. And so now it is getting that stuff that it wants to have. You are giving your brain what it evolved for, as opposed to sitting on a couch, watching TV, not interacting, you know, your eyes and maybe your ears are picking it up, but nothing else. And now your brain is going, this is, you know, it starts pacing inside itself like an animal in a cave.
Right.
Yeah. So evolve to use the plants as medicine, and then also evolve to interact with nature in a way we no longer interact with to maintain our health.
So what advice would you like to give to someone who want to pursue a career similar to that of yours?
Oh, wow. Okay. Be smart. So there is a belief that once you find what you love, figure out how to make medicine, or sorry, how to you know, basically make money from what you love. I did not believe that. I grew up in a poor family. You did what you had to survive, and in the free time, you squeezed in what you loved. And over time, you gotta be patient, but it's what's called a circle of influence. So as you do what you love, you want to try and connect with other people that either do what you love or want to learn how to do what you do. And I recommend focusing on the people that want to learn what you want to do. And so you start teaching them, and that opens up doors. That's what basically happened with me. Before I had the Foraging Texas website and all that, I had a website devoted to hiking and backpacking and kayaking, and it became very popular. But what made it popular is I started, you know, talking about the different plants I was seeing, to the point where people started contacting me and saying, hey, we're going camping next weekend. Will you come with us and teach us about the plants? It's like, yeah, sure. I'll do that. And that opened up more and more doors, to the point where then where different organizations were saying, hey, could you teach our people about how to do this? And it's like, yeah. And so just by doing what I was working in a job I hated to put, you know, food on the table and roof over the heads. But at the same time, I was spending my spare time doing what I loved and sharing it with people. So if you think, the more you can share what you love, the more likely you are to find people who are interested in that same thing, especially now with the internet. I mean, you can reach people all over the world. Yes. And that's how you chase your dream. That's how you harness the end goal of doing what you love to do. Is you may not be able to do it at the beginning, but by sharing it with other people. And your passion, your love. I say now, I'm the luckiest person you will ever meet, because I am doing exactly what I believe the universe created me to do. Why God put me here is to reattach people to these amazing plants and mushrooms that have all these powers that we are ignoring. But everyone has something they are passionate about. And now with the internet, you can connect and share that, but you have to be willing to share that. You have to put a lot of free information out there. you know, and attract people. And then eventually people will start saying, hey, will you come and we'll pay you to teach us this? I was like, ah, finally I made it. So, yeah.
So
I'm giving you really long answers, probably shorter questions.
No. I don't mind, because as much as this is interesting, I don't mind going on for hours.
Okay.
I don't mind at all. So where can my audience connect you?
Okay, so on social media, that's the easiest way. There is, on Facebook, there is the Medicine Man Plant Co. Facebook page. That's where I share the medicinal plant information and also has links to my product line, of course. And then also there's the Foraging Texas, on social media, the Foraging Texas Facebook page, where I share the edible side of things. I've ended up separating, because I found not everyone that's interested in medicinal plants is interested in edible plants, and vice versa. Yeah. And it just seems to better fine tune the audience. Some people follow both, some follow one or the other. Mm-hmm. But really, the center to find on YouTube, it's Dr. Merriweather. I have over 100 hours of plant videos. I would recommend going to the foragingtexas.com website and the social media, and it gives links to all the different social media accounts, all the podcasts I've been on, and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, go there. And from there, you can zero in on specifically what you want to learn from me.
So what does chase your dream mean to you?
So that's it. I like this question. Rye? Because in the end, a lot of people don't catch their dreams. But if you don't try, you're definitely not going to. So chase it. It's not capture your dreams. It's not get your dreams. It's chase your dreams. And, you know, go after and try. Don't sell yourself short. Don't say, I'll never succeed, so why even bother trying? You know what? You're a human. You are the product of thousands and thousands of people who beat the odds through really terrible times. So I like to tell people, you are inherently designed to achieve great things, because all your ancestors did. You're selling yourself short. So go ahead and chase it. Work hard. You know, and try and chase your dreams, and there's a good chance actually you will get it in some form or another.
So with that, we have come to the end of the show. Dr. Mark, it was absolute pleasure to have you as a guest in my show.
Thank you. It was great. You had great questions. I love that.
Thank you for joining us this week. Don't forget to subscribe us on any platform, be it anchor.fm, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, JioSaavn, Castbox, etc. Also, tell your friend, family members and enemies about the show. Be sure to tune in next week for another new episode. Myself Shoman Sengupta signing off. Not before saying, all dreams can come true provided you have the courage to pursue them.